and a slight departure from what we usually hear on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. That is The Kissers, a Madison-based Irish rock band with Ken Fitzsimmons on guitar and vocals, Kevin Youngs on mandolin, Brian Elliott on tin whistle, and Joan Bernstein on boron. I'm Laurie Skelton, sitting in for Veronica Rickert this morning as we get our Irish on a little early, something ahead of St. Patrick's Day, hopefully giving you some of the real Ireland, not only with the music, but with our guest today, Phil Ryan, who is the owner of Inroads Ireland Tour Company and a fabulous Irish storyteller in his own right. Phil, welcome.
Oh, thanks for coming.
And welcome to the band, and welcome to our live studio audience here in Buck Studio on the seventh floor of Vilas Hall in Madison. So we're a little bit early for St. Patrick's Day, but gentlemen in the band, you started us off with a jig this morning, a wedding jig, yes?
Yeah, that's right. It was actually two jigs.
Okay.
We call them the wedding jigs. The first one is called Haste to the Wedding, and the second one I can't remember the name of, actually, which happens a lot.
it's more a matter that it's muscle memory in your fingers as to what you're doing, and muscle memory in your feet as well. What distinguishes a jig from any other dance form?
Well, it's the from a musical perspective, it's a time signature. So a jig is in technically in six or three. So it's like 1 2 3 1 2 3 1 2 3 1 2 3.
Okay. And the steps, can you give us just a basic idea of how you dance a jig, or is it just what happens when you've had one too many pints of Guinness?
Well, no, there is an actual way to jig. It involves keeping your hands and arms straight down to your sides, and then there's a real specific foot step that you do. I cannot demonstrate it.
Okay. One of the problems of radio, I see.
Right. Oh, no, it wouldn't matter if it were radio or not. I couldn't do it. But there certainly is, you know, more of a free-form jig that happens at a lot of our shows. But it's a specific step. And actually, the few times I have attempted to do it, I've been amazed at actually how incredibly difficult it is to do, at least for more than about 10 seconds.
All right. Phil, this seems a little bit strange to ask, but can we start off with an Irish story this morning very quickly that has to do with dancing?
Well, dancing,
Or do you prefer to just dance your stories rather than talk about them?
You know, well, dancing is actually pretty much sort of a very ingrained thing in Ireland. And you know, you have your specific, like your jigs and your Irish step dancing and all those kinds of things. But then possibly what people don't realize as well is that with a lot of mythology, the dance was sort of very much worked into that as well. And even in, you know, little known sort of fact about Ireland is Ireland actually does have its own sort of martial arts, in fact. And some of that was actually based on dance as well, which is sort of a very odd thing that people don't really realize. And so when you look
There's an Irish version of nunchucks?
Yeah, there is, actually.
You're kidding.
Yes, it's crazy as it sounds, you know, as you know, people tend to think of Irish people leaning on bars, drinking Guinness and not like being terribly physical, you know. But they do like to do those things. It's not so much known about. Even in Ireland, actually, you'd find it hard to find anyone that even really knows that themselves. There are some people that think so. Some dance moves, modern dance moves, maybe come from that, from having the kick, and those kinds of things. Also, if you look at sort of ancient warriors in Ireland, they practice with sticks and they practice sort of kicking and different sorts of moves, and these are all part of these defensive or attacking strategies as well. So there's some sort of historical evidence for that kind of stuff. So it's very interesting. So if you look at really any of the ancient sort of warriors or famous people in particular, you know, they'll probably be dancing mixed in with there. But in regard to stories of people dancing, usually there is one that sort of talks about, actually just talking about this the other day, it was on the Hill of Tara, was being attacked every year by this sort of fire fairy that would dance and sing his way in to the great halls of the kings of Ireland. And he had this sort of magic about him, and dance is also a form of magic in ancient Ireland practiced by the fairies. And so the music and the dance is sort of inherently mixed together. And so one of the reasons why, you know, people always say that when you hear Irish music, like you probably felt it when the lads were playing there, that you're, you just can't stop your foot from tapping or your head from bobbing, or you know, even if you don't like Irish music at all, you'll still see people sort of moving in time with it. And they say that that's part of the old fairy magic working its way through the music. And so this fairy, getting back to the story on the hill of Tara, was actually, he would kind of sneak in singing the songs and dancing his magic, and everyone on the hill of Tara would fall asleep. And while they were asleep, he would burn the place to the ground. And, you know, it was a terrible inconvenience, as you can imagine. And he did this every year, sort of as a practical joke. And so the High King of Ireland had summoned all the greatest warriors in Ireland to Hill of Tara, you know, each night before this event would happen. It was a fairly regular occurrence, so we were able to plan around it. So anyway, so there was one young boy who was a guy called Fionn MacCuaim. He was one of the greatest warriors in Ireland, and he was actually trying to reclaim his position as the head of the Fianna. It wasn't actually his in the first place. It was actually his father's, who had been killed before he was born, and there was a whole other story about that. But anyway, he saw this as his birthright, and so he wanted to become the head of the Fianna, which is this band of elite fighting men. They were sort of the special forces of the Irish at the time, I suppose, and their main camp was on the hill of Tara. And of course, with the king summoning all the greatest warriors in Ireland to sort of to see who could fight off this fairy demon or fairy spirit, Cú Chulainn heard about this, and all the men of the Fianna were there as well. So he thought, this would be a great opportunity to do this. And so it had sort of become a tradition, you know, over the years, as, you know, the night before the fairy came and burnt everything down, the king would stand up and say, well, who will stand against this, you know, fire fairy, and who will save Tara tonight? And of course, everyone would stand up and sort of raise their hand and say, oh, I'll do it, no problem, I've got her all under control. And of course, every year they would all fall asleep and the place would burn down. Now, Finn shows up this day, and he's, you know, he's only just sort of beginning to come into manhood. He'd spent all his younger years in training. He'd spent these years with the very wisest people. Even the greatest poets of Ireland had trained him. And so he was very learned, very skilled poet and very skilled warrior, but he was, you know, unproven as yet. So they really didn't take him very seriously when he stood up to sort of announce that he would take on this fire spirit. So it just so happened that within the crowd of people was an old friend of his father's. And so after everyone had sort of, you know, done their oaths and pled their allegiance to saving Tara, they immediately started having a few beers, as you do in Ireland. And so the food's flowing, the beer's flowing, even whiskey and probably some dancing and some music. Everyone's having a great time, despite the fact that they know the whole place is going to burn down in a few hours. But, you know, they weren't going to let that spoil a good party.
So anyway, they'd be warmer anyway.
Yeah, you know, if nothing else, you know, it'll sort of make the morning a bit easier to deal with, you know. So anyway, in the middle of this, you know, the celebrations, this old guy comes up to Finn and says, oh, I was a great friend of your father, and before he died, he entrusted with me his secret bag of weapons. And amidst the secret bag of weapons was a special spear. And the tip of the spear was made of this very special kind of fairy steel. And it was said that in your time of need, if you were confused and erratic and you were just at your wit's end, all you need to do was put this sort of cold fairy steel against your forehead and your thoughts would be immediately cleared and you'd know what to do. And so he thought, well, this will be handy, you know, I'll just stick that right here for now, you know. And so the party went on, everyone's getting a little drunker, you know, and the guys are still getting rowdy. And suddenly they hear this wonderful music floating in from the distance. And everyone's eyes start to kind of close. And then you could see the dancing light of this fairy in the distance coming towards. And he's dancing up and down, his legs are kicking, his arms are spinning, the whole thing. And he works his way in, and everyone's succumbing to this sort of sleep magic of this fairy spirit. Except Finn, because he's had the spear jammed right up against his head all night, just in case. He's been avoiding the liquor as well, just, you know, to give him a little bit more of an edge, you know. So anyway, he doesn't jump up just yet. He decides he's going to let the fairy get closer. And so he sort of slumps over the spear a bit, and everyone else has fallen asleep. And now the fairy is inside. He thinks, oh, the way is clear now. I'll just start setting fire to everything, the usual tradition. And of course, as soon as his back is turned, Finn jumps up on the table, shouts at the fairy, turns around, and he fires the spear as hard as he possibly can. And he fires it so hard, in fact, he takes the fairy's head clean off, and there's a huge explosion of fireworks and probably a bit of a scream as well, as you can imagine. You know, it's a terrible thing to have your head severed by a spear. So anyway, there's a big clunk as the head hit the ground. And of course, as soon as the fairy was killed, the noise, the whole thing, the magic was broken. Everyone in Tara woke up to see Finn carrying this sort of burning charred head of the fairy spirit. And of course, everyone cheered and went, yay, this is awesome. And so they decided that they would have to allow him take his rightful place as the head of the Fianna.
Well, there's a lovely story to get things started.
Yeah, there you go.
Which, And I think right now we need to take a little bit of a break to process this.
Yeah.
We are talking today with Phil Ryan, owner of Inroads Ireland Tour Company, and who is giving us some wonderful Irish stories as we are gearing up for St. Patrick's Day next week. And when we come back, we will also hear more from the Madison-based Irish rock band The Kissers. I'm Laurie Skelton, sitting in for Veronica Rickard on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hold by the hush, my boys, but sure to hold your noise. So listen to poor Paddy's animation. I was by hunger pressed and in poverty distressed. So I took a thought I'd leave the Irish nation. And here's to you, boys, take my advice. To America, I'll suggest you don't go. They do nothing but make war where the murdering cannons roar. And I wish I was back home in dear old Dublin. Well, I sold my only cow, my little pigs and sow, my little plot of land I did part with. And my sweetheart, Bid McGee, I'm afraid I'll never see. For I left her there that morning, broken hearted. Well, myself and 100 more to America sailed o'er. Our fortunes to be made, we were thinking. When we got to Yankee land, put a gun into our hands, saying, Paddy, you must go and fight for Lincoln. And here's to you, boys, take my advice. To America, I suggest you don't go. They do nothing but make war where the murdering cannons roar. And I wish I was back home in dear old Dublin. General Marr, he said, you get shot or lose your head. Well, every one of you will get a pension. Well, myself, I lost a leg. They gave me a wooden peg. And by God, this is the truth to you I mention. Well, I consider myself in luck if I get paid a single buck. While Ireland is the land that I delight in. To the devil I do say, it's cursed America. For I'm sick to death of all of your hard fighting. And here's to you, boys, take my advice. To America, suggest you don't go. They do nothing but make war where the murdering cannons roar. And I wish I was back home in dear old Dublin. Well, here's to you, boys, take my advice. To America, suggest you don't go. Dear old Dublin, and I wish I was back home in dear old Dublin.
Paddy's Lament, performed by the Madison-based Irish rock band The Kissers. And yes, that must have been a shock to go from the famine to the war in the land that was supposed to save you, Ken.
That's right. Certainly pretty quite well depicted by that song.
Even though the word lament is in the title, that still had a fair amount of energy and rhythm to it. Would you say that's pretty typical of an Irish lament, that there's, even though you're bewailing your fate, there's still a great deal of heart in it?
Absolutely. I mean, certainly there are laments which are much slower and more somber sounding, but I think Irish music in general, and certainly a lot of the songs that we choose to play, if you heard the music without the words, you'd be feeling very sort of empowered and sometimes uplifted. And then if you just took just the words and listened to them, you'd be feeling very depressed.
Okay.
But it's sort of an, I feel like it's an embracing of the two to say you can do both. You can have hard times and hard life, but you can still celebrate that through music.
Phil, is that something that you find throughout Irish tales as well? Something that will acknowledge both sides of the story as you're telling it?
Yeah, I would say that. Like most Irish tales, like Irish is sort of a fascination with sort of dark tales and sort of dramas and tragedies. So if you look at most of the great Irish tales all sort of end with lots of people dying, you know? And there's lots of excitement along the way, though. There's love and there's tragedy, and it's sort of like Irish sort of like to celebrate tragedy almost. It's sort of this thing about us. I guess it's the weather in the wintertime or something, you know.
I was about to ask, is this because you spend a lot of time huddled around a peat fire and there's not a lot of light around
you? Pretty much, you know, if you go to Ireland anytime, like really like outside of May to September, you know, you go over the wintertime, it tends to get pretty dark and it can be quite miserable, actually. Most Irish people try and leave Ireland during that time, you know. So if you're ever traveling to Ireland, actually, the May to September are probably the best times in terms of getting a decent amount of weather and the days are longer and stuff like that. So definitely does affect people's psyche. And so like I was saying, most of the great tales are sort of tragic tales. Actually, there's one where there's this young girl who grows up in seclusion. It's all got to do with a curse being put on the Irish people. And there's all most Irish stories have backstories as well, you'll find, and you can kind of get lost in the loops of the backstories sometimes. But anyway, she's said to be the most beautiful girl in all of Ireland when she's born, and it's foretold that she will bring blood on the land, you know, because of her beauty. And so the High King of Ulster has her raised in seclusion, but every year she grows beautifuler, more beautiful and more beautiful each year. And then as she starts to kind of grow into womanhood, he starts to fall deeply and madly in love with her, and he sort of conspires to make her his bride in the end. But because she's held in seclusion, she's sort of raised by this lovely old lady who sort of tells her these great tales, all the folklore and the great warriors and the great poets of Ireland. And she grows up hearing about these great people, and you know, she decides that when she gets older she'd love to kind of marry one of the great poets of Ireland or one of the great warriors. And so she has a very specific idea, you know, that he's meant to be like beautiful dark hair and ruby red lips and porcelain skin and stuff like that. And it's everything that the king isn't, in fact, because by now he's sort of a weird old haggardy old drunk guy with a pot belly and a beard and wrinkles everywhere, you know. So she's not like looking forward to this imminent marriage proposal. So it just so happens there's a band of tree boys wandering through the forest one day, and they're known as the Sons of Naois. And the eldest son, he's a super beautiful guy, and he's pretty much the physical incarnation of what she's always imagined she would fall in love with. And of course, immediately their eyes lock and they're like deeply in love, and they conspire. Well, they've got to escape from here. And so they do. They actually escape with the other two brothers, and they're sent over to an island just off of Scotland. And of course, the king is mad now. He's like, you know, someone found her in the first place.
And then took her to Scotland.
And then took her to Scotland, and she disobeyed him as well, you know. So he's pretty mad. So it's an all points bulletin out all over Ireland, you know. Let's take this guy down. Let's bring her back in handcuffs and chains, the whole thing, you know. But anyway, no one can find them. And eventually, they track down a close friend of the Sons of Naois. He's a guy called Fergus MacGrath. And he was one of the greatest warriors in Ireland. He's got this amazing back tail as well, but we won't get too into that. But anyway, he's very trusted. He's actually probably the most trusted man in Ireland. He was said to have never told a lie. And so they thought he's the perfect guy to go bring them back. So the king lies to him so that he carries this lie. He doesn't have to actually lie to himself. So the king says, well, you go over there and tell them I've forgiven everything, and that they come back and they can live together and be happy ever after, and blah, 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 blah. Of course, it's all a big fat lie, but Fergus doesn't know this, so he believes it, being a very honest man and probably a little bit gullible as well. So he goes over there, convinces them that everything's safe, they can come back to Ireland. Now, of course, while Fergus is with them, the king knows that he can never attack them, you know, his every intention of killing Niche, the son, one of the sons of Niche, and the young girl. Not the young girl, he wants to marry her, but he's going to kill the rest of them. But he knows that Fergus, being this great and very honourable man, won't let that happen. And he was also, at the time, the most skilled warrior in Ireland, so you weren't going to mess with him either, you know. So, unfortunately for Fergus, he had this secret oath. In Ireland, there's these secret oaths called geshes. And his gesh was that he could never turn down hospitality, which is a fairly handy one, you know. You know, someone's going to give you a beer. Okay, I'll have a beer, you know. Sure, come on, I'll have a party. Oh, sure, no problem, I'll have a party. I'm actually, it's my sacred oath, in fact, to party, you know. So it was a good one. So anyway, the king conspired with another chieftain. So he sort of intersected them before he came back to the main, you know, the main king in the north of Ireland. And so he said, well, you're invited to this party. And so that split up the group. Fergus was oath-bound to go to the party, and thus the three brothers of Niche and the young girl, the daughter, Deirdre was her name actually, and she was brought in to the king, and they attacked, grabbed a whole lot of them, and then that was it. And so in his anger, the king had one of his kind of sidekicks, who was a not too pleasant man, actually put his sword through the young guys and killed a lot of them. And sort of course, Deirdre, the young girl, was completely heartbroken at this. And then the king was like, well, you're going to marry me now, you're going to fulfill the promise. And she said, no, I'll never marry you, and start calling them names and stuff like that. And so as punishment for a year, he gave her to the guy that killed her lover and the two brothers. And of course, this was a terrible tragedy, as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, rather than accept this fate, as this kind of sidekick guy was taken away in his chariot, she saw a large outcrop of rock. And as she passed by, as the horses charged with this chariot passed by, she stuck her head out and slammed it into the rocks, killing herself instantly. And that ended poor old Deirdre. And that was the story. And then Fergus, of course, the story doesn't end there, even though it is a great tragedy. There's more. Fergus, of course, finds out what's happened in the meantime. He realizes he's been tricked. And he saw that, you know, he, you know, his kids were under his protection. So he's mad now. He's been lied to. His honor has been, like, tainted. And so he raises an army and basically slaughters all the king and all his men. And so the north of Ireland is covered in blood. And so the prophecy at the beginning is sort of fulfilled. And there you go.
And there you go.
So there's a lot of excitement. There's love. There's hope. Then there's some war, there's some fighting, there's a bit of a party somewhere in the middle, usually something involving a party. And then everyone dies in the end.
And everyone dies in the end. Now, so, if you have any questions about Irish tales or Irish music, you can call us this morning at 800-642-1234. And while we're waiting for phone calls or comments, let's get back to the business at hand next Thursday, St. Patrick's Day, when all of America turns Irish. Would you mind taking a few minutes and telling us what we get wrong about celebrating?
Well, it's a funny thing, you know, St. Patrick's Day in Ireland. Like, it's only relatively recent that Irish people actually start taking St. Patrick's Day seriously. Like, up until about 15, maybe 20 years ago, it wasn't really a big deal at all. In fact, like, they did have parades in Ireland, but they were sort of more of a source of local embarrassment than anything else, because it was usually like a fairly small parade. It might have a farmer and his tractor followed by a couple of sheep, you know, and that was fairly typical of
and
you
somebody
know.
Waving a snake just for
somebody waving something or other, you know, a couple of girls kicking their legs along, kind of a thing, you know, half arsed, as we'd say in Ireland, kind of a thing, you know. So it was really more of a holy day where you went to mass, and that was really the main thing, and you might have a meal with your family, that kind of a thing. But how it became big, actually, in recent years, it's more to do with Irish Americans than Irish, if you could say that, you know. And it goes back to, much like the song the guys were talking about, when they, you know, they came to America after the famine in kind of the mid to late 1800s. The Irish were very impoverished, as you probably know, but they were also very keen on retaining their Irish culture. And so they started to celebrate saints' days, you know, as a way of coming together for these mass, and they would have meals and things like that. They started celebrating the music and things. And so having a meal associated with St. Patrick's Day became a big thing as well. And so this is where the old corned beef and cabbage thing comes into play, which I'll have to say right now that in Ireland, nobody eats corned beef and cabbage. That's one of the biggest myths of all.
So how did we get it?
Well, this actually, in Ireland, what people have, what's the sort of the favorite thing for like special occasions and things like that is actually bacon and cabbage. So you usually get like a big side of bacon or a big lump of ham or something like that. And it's usually boiled, in fact. And right at the end, cabbage is quite a popular, you know, plant in Ireland. So they'll actually boil the leaves in the water with the ham and the bacon, so you get that lovely flavor flowing out. It's actually very good if anyone wants to try that at home on St. Patrick's Day. That would be a much more traditional Irish meal. But when they came to the States, of course, they were impoverished. They couldn't afford, you know, ham or bacon, those kinds of things. So they actually got in league with Jewish butchers, and they got sort of a processed beef, basically the precursor to corned beef, sort of a, you know, a brisket type thing. It was basically the worst of whatever was left over, mixed with something, disguised as something else, and then packaged in something else again, you know, because if you knew what it was, you wouldn't eat it. So that's what they bought, because that was all they could afford. And so that's where the corned beef comes in. So it's really more of an Irish American thing. And of course, the celebrations with these new Irish Americans got bigger and bigger each year. St. Patrick's Day sort of came to the fore because he was the best known of the saints of Ireland. And so this is really how the St. Patrick's Day thing happened. It was actually much, much bigger on the east coast of America than it ever was in Ireland, in fact.
Okay, gentlemen, obviously, St. Patrick's Day and the days leading up to it, a great time for an Irish band to be playing out. But on this idea of what do Americans get wrong about St. Patrick's Day, what's the one thing that we think we know about Irish music that you would like to completely kick out of our consciousness today? What don't we know? What's the big misconception that you'd like to get rid of?
Well, we talk about traditional Irish music.
Yeah.
And I guess all I could really say is, and I heard this recently, someone say, the only tradition that doesn't change is a dead tradition.
Okay.
So we deem ourselves Irish rock, and what we do is our take on Irish music and traditional and what we call Irish traditional music, which, you know, for some groups, their focus is very much in recreating the traditional sound sort of in an authentic way, whereas we are more interested in sort of modernizing it, and we feel that that's in the spirit of Irish music. It's truly in the spirit of Irish music.
All right. Well, on that note, Chris in Two Rivers has a question. Chris, thanks for holding. Chris?
Yeah, it's talking about Irish music. There's a lot of similarities I see with Irish music and bluegrass. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, certainly. They both use the same three chords.
You can say that about a lot of classical music,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. I'm no historian, but I do know that a lot of Irish settled in both northern and southern United States. And so there are really, I believe, direct connections between bluegrass and Irish music. And from a musical perspective, you know, even our instrument, well, sort of half our instrumentation. So today we have mandolin and guitar. We could basically be playing a bluegrass tune and you'd hardly even know. A little later in the show we're going to play an Irish song and you would almost think we're a bluegrass band playing it. Tin whistle and ball run. Okay, so those are a little bit more Irish. But certainly the instruments, we might have a banjo up here. It's possible to have an upright bass or an electric bass. So musically speaking, very, very close. And I think historically there are roots. They come from similar roots.
All right. And thank you for that call. And let's see. Can we get Barbara on right now? Barbara, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that last summer I went to Ireland. It was the first time I'd ever been there. I went with my sister and we came to Ireland because she didn't want to go somewhere where she couldn't understand the language.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
And let me guess, you got over there and were very surprised.
It was very interesting. I mean, neither of us knew, you know, much. We came from an Irish family long ago. And I realized that the minute I got there, I felt so at home. I felt so connected. And one of the things that made me feel that way was the traditional music everywhere. And I found this kind of emotion growing in me until one time we were waiting for the ferry in a little town called Doolin to go to the Aran Islands. And these musicians came in and started playing, and they started playing a song called I Remember Doolin, about someone who was forced to go to the United States and was thinking. And I burst into tears in the middle of the bar. It really got to me, and I still have a very strong connection there. I think sometimes, you know, we Americans forget about our roots, and now I listen to lots of Irish music. It teaches history, and it gives us a good sense of who we are.
Barbara, everyone in the studio is nodding as you're saying this. Who wants to respond to Barbara here?
I would respond to that because it's interesting because when she said that, I was thinking, oh, this sounds like Doolin. And of course it was when she actually said where you'd been. It's quite a popular place for people to go in Ireland, especially for music. And I'm sure the lads might even have gone there at one point or other, you know.
Okay.
And it's really sort of a mecca for Irish music. And you can go any night of the year, even Christmas night, you'll find Irish music in the town of Doolin. It's not even much of a town, to be honest. It's part of a mile stretch of a road. And it's got some bars and hotels and B&Bs stretched across it. But even with that, they seem to find this sort of weird sort of musical community. So it's a really great place to go for music. And especially with the islands connected there, they also have a very strong tradition of music. I don't know which island that Barbara was going over to, but there's three wonderful islands. There's Inishir, Inishman and Inishmur. And Inishman in particular I like for music because it's got one bar on the whole island, you know, and this is really where everyone on the island comes together. And because of that sort of unique location that this sort of community pulls together, you really get these incredible impromptu kind of sessions there all the time. And I've been there where locals just show up, and like usually a good session will start around 12 at night.
Okay.
And, you know, they'll come in from fishing or farming, and it'll be a mad session that goes on for hours.
And Ken, it sounds like this is the perfect place where you were talking about the tradition is growing, evolving, that something, pardon me using an overused word this hour, something magic can happen in that setting.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, the late night session where people come in from all around and sort of pick up some of the tunes that maybe you didn't know before and share some of yours, and all of a sudden it's being passed back and forth you know, through, of course, Ireland's rich oral tradition,
mm-hmm.
or aural tradition. and then they take, maybe learn a couple new tunes, take those home and play them over there, and they change a little bit, and maybe they can't remember the name of them, or they change the name, and it keeps getting passed around and is sort of that living tradition.
All right. We'll be back for more of this living tradition, songs and tales from Ireland, tales from Phil Ryan, music from the Kissers. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The Kissers, live in Buck's studio in Wisconsin Public Radio's largest room for music. Gentlemen, a series of reels on that one?
That's right. It was a set of two reels. Master Crowley's and Ships Are Sailing.
We're here with the Kissers and with storyteller Phil Ryan as we're getting our Irish up a little early, getting ready for St. Patrick's Day next week. And Joel is joining us from Middleton. Good morning, Joel.
Good morning. I started with one question. I have two and an observation. As the descendant of a Jew and an Irish woman, the background of corned beef for St. Patrick's Day is especially heartwarming.
Bravo.
And I want to, my first question is, in what way are Irish folk tales reflective of Celtic tales when the Celtic world extended from the Baltic Sea to the Canary Islands? Is it derivative? Is it some way part of that? And the second thing has to do with music. I wonder if the Celts gave Europe its sense of musicality, its sense of tunefulness, because it doesn't seem to be derivative of any Asian or African. I mean, that's been added later. But I think the Celts gave us far more than our ordinary teachings of history have ever indicated.
Wow.
Yeah, well, that's quite a question, actually, with the Celts. They covered a massive geographic reading, like you said, and in particular Ireland. And Ireland actually held on to its Celtic heritage probably more so than anyone else, just because of seclusion. You know, we were really like the furthest island out from Europe. It was hard to get to. It was bad weather, really when the Celts came to Ireland, it was sort of, they kind of stayed there. And it's sort of unusual in that it wasn't really this invasion of like hordes of men pouring over over the ocean in boats, taking over the country. It was really more of a cultural exchange in terms. So before the Celts, there was probably music, indigenous music in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Northern France, places like that, that we don't know too much about. And they have found sort of various little kind of bone flutes and different things, and even evidence of some stringed instruments as well. So the tunings are often very much locked into language, and then Ireland would have had a very ancient form of language at that point. And then when the Celts came in, they brought in, you know, the main Celtic language, and in the rest of Europe, as opposed to Ireland, it actually evolved slightly different. Ireland held on to sort of an older form of Gaelic, whereas the rest of Europe kind of expanded and developed further on. And so that link with the language and the tuning and song probably had that sort of strange effect. Now, the Irish also were great travellers, and so they spread and took different pieces from here and there, and you had various waves of different people coming in. So it was sort of a weird melting pot mixed with long stretches of seclusion. That's probably why you have this sort of strange sort of Celtic music background and different intonations.
And how do Irish tales, the stories, how does that permeate into other cultures?
Well, Irish, as I say, like Ireland, they're great travellers, and so their tales have always mixed with other people's tales, and they've taken from other people's tales and giving to other people's tales, like the story of Trista and Isolde. That's actually another tale that comes from Dermot and Grainne in Ireland, which is an almost identical tale but based in Ireland, and actually set with our friend Finn McCool, who we talked about earlier on. He's actually the bad guy in this particular sense. And so Irish tales are always evolving and changing and having an influence and moving around and taking bits from that and adding to others.
Does that mean now is a good time to bring up St. Patrick and get to what really happened?
Well, there's a thing with St. Patrick himself, with him coming up on the, on the 17th, as it were. He is Ireland's most famous saint, but actually most people don't realise there's actually two other patron saints of Ireland, as St. Bridget and St. Colum Kyle. So it's sort of a shared title. He sort of became popular because there was some documentation relating to him left, whereas there isn't much for the other two, and so he sort of became the one that people talked about most. But one of the things he's most famous for is ridding Ireland of snakes and serpents, and this was often used as a sort of a metaphor for the older religions, the indigenous religions, the Celtic religions that were there before Christianity came in. But it's said that he fasted on this holy mountain on the west coast of Ireland called Croagh-Patrick, which literally translates as Patrick's Mountain or Patrick's Peak. And so he went up there for 40 days and 40 nights, nights, and he brought with him his holy bell. And this was another thing that was very symbolic of early Irish missionaries bringing Christianity to the country. They would ring a bell. And so, metaphorically, this was seen as the weapon of choice for the Christians against the earlier pagan religions. And so he rang this bell every night for 40 days and 40 nights, and the serpent, seeing this, wanted to attack the bell to get rid of it, to stop this sort of invasion, as it were, for them. And he would throw the bell out over the sea each night. Of course, serpents can't swim. They all fell into the ocean and drowned. And then, as luck would have it, a couple of friendly angels just happened to be hovering around the sea for 40 days and 40 nights.
Just happened to be there.
And they would grab the bell each time and bring it back to him, and he'd do the same the next night. And he kept this up until all the serpents and snakes were gone from Ireland. And so that's one of the great tales of St. Patrick's Day. And you'll often see him depicted carrying a big staff with a snake wrapping around it, and that sort of relates to that particular tale.
And nobody's ever tried to tie that into a caduceus?
Maybe. Could be.
All right. I think we've got time for one other tale from the phones. Buck is joining us from Madison. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. What a good show. I love Ireland. Have been there, and at Mass, when we pray for blessings, I bless Ireland. I have a question for you. You know, in the taking of the brown bull of Cluny, you know, Cool and stuff, there's Ulster against the rest of Ireland. Mm-hmm. So is this hostility or division way, way back? Well, long before those pesky Normans ever showed up.
Well, I would sort of take that one. It's actually a very interesting tale, and the tales he's talking about are from the Ulster Cycle, and the Teinga Bulga, in fact, which is the one he referred to. The thing about Ireland is that Ireland was never a united country, and even within the north of Ireland, there were smaller kingdoms, and so it did tend to sort of, you had various epic tales would happen in one region, fighting against another region, fighting against another region. And so this the north has always been a particularly kind of fiery place in terms of epic tales, and that's why it sort of gets singled out a lot. In particular, like, there's one famous hero called Cú Chulainn, and he's said to be half a fairy god, in fact, and he's sort of one of the main characters in the Teinga Bulga. It's all about basically a jealous queen and her husband fighting over their wealth, and they cause this great battle over a bull, and all these great warriors are summoned to fight against each other. They all die in the end. They get the bulls, and then they end up being equally in power at the end. So this is great tragedy where everyone dies pretty much for nothing at the end of the tale. But there's a lot of love, lust, and banqueting all the way between the middle of it. And that all sort of happens actually not in the north of Ireland, but just south of it in the Midlands region. There actually used to be another province in Ireland that people don't often hear about called the province of Meath. It's sort of the fifth unknown province. And when Christianity came in, there was a bit of reworking of the areas. And so that sort of got lost over time. But so a lot of the Ulster Cycle, a lot of those tales actually happen in areas of Connacht, which is just south of the traditional Ulster that you know now, and in the North Midlands region of Meath. So there's sort of a bit of a mix of those two. So it's not a clear division of like Ulster it is. And all those borders in ancient Ireland were constantly shifting all the time. Provinces were moving in and out and changing power. And a lot of the great heroes and warriors and tales like go from one top of the part of the country down to the bottom part of the country. In fact, Cú Chulainn is said at one point to have held off the king of the world on a beach off of Dingle, off the Dingle Peninsula, for a year and a day. And so he moves around. So there is this sort of Ulster identity with that, but then, you know, it mixes and mingles. There's no like clear division.
You also said a few minutes ago that Ireland is not really one country, that there are divisions still to be found. If you can leave us with one thought today, if someone wants to take being Irish in America to something past St. Patrick's Day, what could one hold on to as something that is wonderfully Irish that you can keep in your life?
Well, it's really storytelling and history and chat, conversation. That is really the ultimate thing in Ireland. Everything in Ireland happens around socializing. People love to talk. They love to pass on tales. They love to pass on musical tunes. And even music is a vehicle for conversation, which is why this, when you hear Irish songs, they're not just sort of simple songs. They're tales, you know, embroidered into these musical structures. You know, it's another way of socializing, passing on talk and conversation and history.
So every time you put mm-hmm. down the BlackBerry, you're Irish.
Yeah, pretty much. If you're talking, you're Irish.
Well, that's a marvelous yeah. way to think about it. And Phil Ryan, I thank you so much for telling us tales today. But I think we need to round things off with the Kissers. Before we turn to the band again, let me just say that I am Laurie Skelton sitting in for Veronica Rickard. She'll be back next week. And we are deeply indebted to having all of you here in the studio, giving us more than a little bit of energy, enjoyment, definitely more than a little bit of Irish to go out on. Ken, would you explain what it is you're going to play us out with today?
Sure. We're going to play probably one of the most famous of Irish pub songs. It's the Irish Rover.
Okay.
And basically, it's about a ship, and of course, the ship sinks in the end.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, the Kissers on Wisconsin Public Radio.
One, two, three.
On the 4th of July, 1806, we set sail for the cocaine port. We were sailing away with a cargo of bricks for the Grand City Hall in New York. 'Twas a wonderful craft, she was rigged for a doubt. And know how the wild wind drove her. She set sail for a blast, jet 27 masts, and they called her the Irish Rover. There was 1 million bags of the best Sligo rags, we had 2 million barrels of stone, and we had 3 million sides of a flying horse.